The Naples Council on World Affairs Lecture Series welcomes Ambassador William Taylor this evening, and it's truly a pleasure to have you here. This has been a long courtship getting you here, one that has been planned to come to fruition in October of 2017 originally, but lo and behold, along came the interference of another woman, Irma. In any case, Mr. Ambassador, we are so pleased to have overcome the interloper, and we do welcome you this evening. Ambassador Taylor has represented our country in many capacities, as you have read in your invitations, whether it was in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, the former Soviet Union, and Eastern Europe. His years at West Point and the Kennedy School at Harvard surely prepared him well for the tasks his career has provided. Today, he is Executive Vice President of the United States Institute of Peace, whose mandate encourages peace-building efforts for the assurance of our national security. But listen, we couldn't pass up the opportunity to be sure that a little excitement in the Crimea might inspire him to give us a little inside look on another hot topic for today's lecture. So let's welcome Ambassador William Taylor to tell us all about it.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I am delighted, I'm astounded that that this is a nearly full auditorium here. And so I hope I can engage you. And I hope I can engage you enough so that you will challenge me. And so I'll try to tell you some stories about the kind of things that the Institute of Peace is doing around the world and in some of the places that Mimi just described. But I hope that something that I say will stick with you that says, no, that's not right. And if you hear something that I say that you think is not right, I would love for you to come to one of these microphones here afterwards and ask questions, because I do appreciate that kind of response and reaction. So that will do. The Institute of Peace, and Mimi described a little bit of that, is something that some of you may not be familiar with. However, there are probably people in this room who do know about the Institute of Peace, and one of the people who works at the Institute of Peace is Alana Lancaster, and I'm told that her parents are here somewhere, and here they are. So welcome, glad to have you, and she does great work. I would say that in any case, but she does. We're really pleased to have Alana there. The Institute of Peace was the idea of World War II veterans. Several of the members of the Senate back in the 70s, in the middle of the Cold War, recognized that the U.S. government was pretty well suited and capable of dealing with conflict, violent conflict, abroad militarily through violence. But it was not well suited, the U.S. government was not well suited to kind of think through how to resolve violent conflict without violence. And so these veterans, Senator Hatfield, Senator Matsunaga, thought about how to remedy that problem, and they thought it was going to be, they suggested, a peace academy, United States Peace Academy. Well, I went to the United States Military Academy, and they thought a good idea would have a United States Peace Academy, along with the Naval Academy and the Air Force Academy, if there are Naval Academy grads and Air Force Academy grads in the room. Instead, what came out of those discussions in the Senate and in the House of Representatives was the Institute of Peace. So we work abroad. We are set up to work in places like Iraq, Afghanistan. We have offices in Tunisia, we work in Nigeria. We also assemble and convene discussions of policy in Washington. Our building, which you all have probably seen in Washington, is right next to the State Department, so we have the opportunity to both bring State Department people over to our discussions, but also to go back across the street and talk to them about recommendations that we make, that we've come up with based on our discussions with a wide range of people that would help them on national security and on their work. So let me describe, to give you a sense of what it is we do and what we do for you, because we are funded by the U.S. Congress. That is, we're funded by U.S. taxpayers. And so yeah, I think it's important for you to understand what we're doing in your name and your behalf. And we do these in various places, and I'll talk about three of them. I'll talk about Iraq, talk about Afghanistan, and then at Mimi's suggestion, I will talk about Ukraine and Russia. And then, hopefully, something that I will have said in those three conversations will prompt you to come to the mics and challenge. Iraq. You will recall that ISIS, well after the U.S. troops were withdrawn from Iraq, so well after Saddam Hussein was toppled, and well after the establishment of that of new governments in Iraq, ISIS took advantage of the departure of U.S. troops and came through, came from the northwest and came through Iraq. They pushed all the way to the town of Tikrit, which you will recall was the home of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was Sunni Muslim. So Tikrit is a Sunni Muslim city, community. Just beyond that was and is a former U.S. Army base. So when we were there, when the U.S. military was there, we established a base. It's called Camp Spiker. Where we operated out of. It turns out, actually, that my son, who was also in the Army, operated out of Camp Spiker when he was there earlier in 2008. But this is now 2015. ISIS came through, overran Tikrit, overran Camp Spiker. The Iraqi military, when we left, had set up a training facility. And this training facility, run by the Iraqis, had 1,700 cadets being trained there, and those cadets were mostly Shia. When ISIS came through, they massacred 1,700 of these Shia cadets, mostly Shia. A horrible event that seared the community. The Iraqi army eventually, several months later, pushed, as we know, pushed ISIS back out, pushed them back out of Spiker, back out of Tikrit, indeed mostly out of Iraq. But back in Tikrit, now under control of the Iraqis, but under the control of the Iraqi militia, that's from the southern militia, that were mainly Shia, the Sunni communities that lived in Tikrit area were so terrified, because tribal custom is to seek revenge against those tribes, other tribes that perpetrated that massacre. So the tribes that were accused of perpetrating that massacre under the guise of ISIS were Sunni, and the cadets were mostly Shia. So the Sunni tribes were very concerned, terrified, of revenge. The community around Tikrit and Spiker fled. They spread out around other parts of Iraq. The Institute of Peace, this is where I'm coming back to what we have done. So for 10 years, the Institute of Peace has been training Iraqis in the skills of facilitation, of mediation, of dialogue, of conflict resolution. And we had a team of Iraqi facilitators who identified this problem of potential revenge and the disruption to the community, the Sunni community, spread back out over the other parts of Iraq. So our facilitators sat down with the tribal leaders of the Shia tribes and had conversations about what had gone on and what could be done. Separately, our facilitators sat down with the Sunni tribal leaders and worked out, described, came to grips with what had happened during that massacre. Eventually, our facilitators, again, these are Iraqis, these are not American employees of USIP, but these are Iraqi citizens, facilitators, trained by the Institute of Peace, got them together, got both sides together, and were able to work out an agreement whereby the Sunni tribes offered up the perpetrators that were still there of the massacre to the Iraqi judicial system. And in return, the Shia tribal leaders agreed not to seek revenge, which would have been the normal response, which would have been the traditional response. And that agreement held. And it held to the degree, a demonstration, evidence of that agreement holding, was that the 350,000 Sunnis in that community who had fled for fear of revenge came back. And they resettled, and they continue today. So this is the kind of work that the Institute of Peace can do, has done, really at the almost grassroots level in Iraq, that this case. There is another level of work that we also do. And so the other level is going to be the next two stories, the next two pieces. But I am serious about questions and challenges and questions about this kind of work. But the next one has to do with Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan just before Thanksgiving, so I spent a couple of weeks in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and came home just before Thanksgiving with a change in attitude. I came back thinking, and my colleagues shared this attitude, that there is some hope for resolving this 17-year-old war. Hope, Afghanistan, not normally in the same sentence, certainly not lately. But there were things that we saw on our trip just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, both in Afghanistan and in the United States, and in Pakistan, which I'll talk about in a minute, that lead us to think that there is some hope for a negotiated solution to that war. You should be skeptical, and you should challenge me on this, but let me try to give you the evidence that we saw. First of all, there's going to be a presidential election in Afghanistan next April. There are already people maneuvering to put together slates and teams of president, vice presidents, CEOs, a team of people and another team of people. And of course, the current president, Ashraf Ghani, is doing the same thing. Unlike before, unlike even a year ago, all three of the major groupings, which include people from the Northern Alliance, people from the Tajik community, people from the Uzbek community, all of the communities and all of the potential presidential candidates are running on a peace platform. Now, that may not sound unusual, but it's very unusual. Most of the thinking of, in particular, of the Northern Alliance part of Afghanistan, the Uzbeks and Tajiks, for all this time, up until maybe a year ago, thought that the solution to the Taliban was to kill them, was to wipe them out. That was the answer. And frankly, some in the U.S. military had the same view. I'll come back to that change. But now, all of the politicians, all the potential presidents who get a sense of what the mood of the political body, what the mood of the voters is, sense that there is weariness, that they are fed up, they're weary, they're frustrated, they're tired of being afraid, the Afghan people. Wives are are tired of being afraid, really terrified, that when their husband goes off to work, he may not come home. Or when their son or daughter goes off to school, they may not come home. This has worn on them 17 years, and it's palpable. Another bit of evidence reinforces that something different is going on in Afghanistan is a ceasefire. Now here again, you would think, ceasefire, of course they should have a ceasefire. Well, they hadn't had a successful ceasefire in 17 years. But after the Eid holiday, the Eid Muslim holiday, in June, just past June, both sides, both the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban, announced a three-day ceasefire. No one was real sure if it would hold, or if it would matter, or anybody would notice, because ceasefires had been tried in the past, failed. This one didn't. This one succeeded. Beyond dreams, it succeeded. The Taliban put down their weapons, the government troops put down their weapons, and the Taliban came to the cities. They fight mainly, and they're mainly in the rural areas. The Taliban put down their weapons, came to the cities, and embraced the government fighters, the government soldiers. Government soldiers and the Taliban rode around the cities on motorbikes, waving flags, taking selfies together, eating ice cream together. This was a major event in Afghanistan history. And it just goes to the depth and the hunger for peace on the part of both the soldiers, the Taliban, as well as the people. That's in Afghanistan. Let me tell you another reason I'm optimistic about a negotiated peace in Afghanistan is what's going on in the United States. I mentioned earlier that there are those who thought, up until maybe a year ago, like the Tajiks and the Uzbeks communities, that the only way we're going to end this war was to kill all the Taliban. We're going to win this war militarily, it was thought. No longer. Our military, under General Nicholson, who was there for 5 years and earlier and many years, who's recently come back to be replaced by General Scotty Miller, these two generals, commanders of troops, are among the most enthusiastic proponents of a negotiated peace. And that wasn't true before. Our hearts, the American hearts, were not in negotiations. We said it, we even tried it. We had some people talking to the Taliban quietly, even secretly, but it didn't go anywhere, and we frankly didn't push it. So that is a big change. Our military and our State Department, our government is now behind this. And another indication that this is something that the Americans is that President Trump and Secretary Pompeo have designated, have anointed, if you will, Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. They have designated him as a special envoy to negotiate a peace deal with the Taliban. Now, some of you in this room may have met Ambassador Khalilzad. He is a force. He is colorful. He was born in Afghanistan, as you can kind of tell from his name, Khalilzad. He knows this country. He knows these people. He knows the leaders, both on all sides of the political spectrum in Afghanistan. He is the perfect guy to do this, and he has been given the responsibility by President Trump, Secretary Pompeo, to get a peace. Ambassador Khalilzad is under some pressure to succeed, and to succeed in a hurry. As we know, our president, President Trump, is an impatient man. He could pull the U.S. troops out of Afghanistan tomorrow. If he did, Ambassador Khalilzad would have no chance of negotiating a peace. So Ambassador Khalilzad is eager to make progress so that he can keep President Trump from pulling the troops out, and that we can finally resolve this 17-year-old war. And I think it's possible. Last bit of evidence. I mentioned we went from Kabul to Pakistan. Pakistan has been accused, rightly in my own view, for years of providing safe haven for the Taliban when they were under pressure in Afghanistan. They would just come across the border into Pakistan, and the forces, Afghan forces, American forces, could not pursue them. So 3 weeks ago, we were in Islamabad. We met the new Pakistani Prime Minister, Prime Minister Imran Khan. Cricket player, cricket hero in Pakistan, new to the job, frank, I believe genuine in what he told us, and what he told us was, we are desperate for peace in Afghanistan. He said, you can't imagine how important peace in Afghanistan is to us and our economy. As he was saying this, of course, sitting beside him and off to the side were some of his foreign policy advisors. And you could see them kind of wince and, they were very uncomfortable with their prime minister being so frank with these Americans and saying how desperate Pakistan was for a peace deal and how Pakistan was going to help the Americans and the Afghans achieve this peace. That's different. That's different. Now, some of you in this room have probably dealt with Pakistanis, and you will know that there's a very powerful military and intelligence services and usually a less powerful civilian government. Nonetheless, Imran Khan was elected recently with the support of the military and the intelligence services and the support of a majority of Pakistanis. So that indicates that there is a chance for this to happen. For this peace deal to happen, that the Pakistanis may be part of that solution. So, those three reasons, what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on here in the United States, and what's going on in Pakistan, lead me to believe that there is a chance. There is a chance. It's not by no means, it's probably not above 50%, but it's much higher than it's ever been. And as I say, Ambassador Khalilzad has a real incentive to get this thing done. My last story. So hang on to your questions about Iraq. Questions about Afghanistan. Last story is on Ukraine and Russia. So just as I got back from Ukraine, so I was in Ukraine just before Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving weekend, the Russians attacked the Ukrainian Navy. The Russians, as you recall, in 2014, invaded and illegally annexed a part of Ukraine called Crimea. Crimea is a peninsula at the bottom, at the southern part of Ukraine. It sticks out into the Black Sea. And the eastern tip of Crimea, this peninsula, is about 12 miles from the Russian mainland. Okay, so that little stretch of water between the eastern tip of Crimea, which was part of, and still, in my view, part of Ukraine, but occupied by the Russians, and the Russian mainland, and ships used to go back and forth through that strait. They'd go up into the Sea of Azov, up into that sea where there are seaports, both on the Russian side and on the Ukrainian side. And up until Thanksgiving weekend, a week ago, this was not a problem. And Ukrainian ships went in and out, Russian ships went in and out, everybody coordinated, and that was not a problem. Last weekend, the Russians clamped down. And so there were three Navy vessels. I won't even call them ships because they're small. They're very small. They're actually two small gunboats, and one tug. And this little three-vessel flotilla started off in Odessa in Ukraine and sailed around the peninsula of Crimea and came up towards the Kerch Strait, that little strait that I was talking about, en route to another Ukrainian port, Mariupol, on the Sea of Azov. This time, the Russians said, no, you can't come through. And they said, the Russians said to them, stay over here in this little waiting area. While the three Ukrainian ships were in that little waiting area, 10 Russian ships, much larger, of their border police, their military border police, came over, and one of them rammed the little tug 3 times. Then helicopters attacked all three of these ships, and aircraft came in and strafed these ships. And so the Ukrainians were trying to leave. They were trying to go back through the Black Sea, going back to Odessa, but the Russians attacked them. The significance of this is that the Russians dropped all pretense. The Russians had pretended over the last 4 or 5 years that they weren't stirring up trouble in Ukraine. When they first invaded and took over Crimea and annexed Crimea, you may remember that President Putin said, not ours, you know, these little green men, they were called, had no insignia on their uniform. They were clearly Russian soldiers. But President Putin denied it for a while. Then he slipped out a couple months later and said, oh, actually, they were ours. But then he said the trouble in Donbas, the trouble in the southwestern part of Ukraine that he had stirred up after having annexed Crimea, was not his. He said, oh, those are just, it's a civil war. Those are separatists in that part of Ukraine that are fighting against the government, which everybody understands totally is not the case. But that was the pretense that he had. Well, he dropped all pretense last weekend when he had Russian troops under Russian flag, Russian equipment, these patrol boats, attacking very openly, explicitly, Ukrainian. So the question is, what are we to do? What's the West to do? What are the Ukrainians to do? The Ukrainians, you know, have put up a fight and trying to defend themselves. And in this four-year fight, so this started in 2014, 10,000 Ukrainians have died in Ukraine, fighting against the Russian and the Russian separatists. 10,000. So this is in the heart of Europe. This is a war going on, and we hear very little about it. And the question is, what do we do about that? Now we have another example where it's very clear the Russians don't deny that they are attacking the Ukrainians. So the question for us is kind of what we do. Institute of Peace is doing something. We've been doing some work with some dialogues, some kind of track two dialogues, which are not official dialogues, but we pull together senior Russians and senior Ukrainians and senior Americans, all of whom used to be in the government and now are not, but all of whom are in touch with their governments. So that these dialogues, these discussions, where we've come up with some proposals, some ideas on how to get the Russians out of Donbas, out of Ukraine. And we've all taken these proposals to our respective governments, and we're still working on that. So I'm not as optimistic about Mr. Putin or the Russians as I am on Afghanistan. We've had some success in Iraq. I'm hoping that something that we have talked about here so far about Iraq, Afghanistan, Ukraine, has triggered something in some minds, ideas here, and I'd love to get your thoughts. There are microphones here. Greg will help moderate this, but thank you very much so far. Let me turn it over. Yep.
First question from over here.
Excellent, excellent. Two brave people. The first people to ask questions are the bravest people in the room. Sir.
I have to be brave because you are a professional diplomat and I'm a newspaper reader. Thinking about your discussion of the prospects for a negotiated peace in Afghanistan. Thinking back over the history of the Taliban, the history of Afghanistan over the last, let's say, century, two centuries, thinking about what we've seen of the Taliban, it's difficult not to, for me, not to have come to mind the phrase "peace with honor." I'm sure you're familiar with that phrase.
Yes.
I'm sure you remember it.
Yes.
What real reason is there to think that the Taliban will not agree to a peace and then continue to pursue the objectives they have pursued over decades now, and which we momentarily interrupted or episodically have interrupted over the last 17 years? And if that were to be true, certainly the Taliban will continue to inflict endless misery in Afghanistan as they did when they came to power. But if we're not going to prevent that, if we're not able to prevent that, is there anything to be said for, and I really hate to agree with anything President Trump might think, but is there anything to be said for our ceasing to inflict that kind of misery through the combat that we're pursuing now?
This is a very good question. This is an important question. And there is an answer. First of all, totally agree that the Taliban, when they were in power 17 years ago, were horribly autocratic. Girls couldn't go to school at all. Women had to be totally covered. We know all this. They totally rejected the Afghan constitution and all of the values and principles that are included there. And so why would we want to talk to these folks and come to some kind of an agreement with these folks so that they could play some role in a new Afghanistan government? Perfectly legitimate question. One of the things that we've been doing, that we, the Institute of Peace, have been doing, is having unofficial conversations with the current crop of Taliban. The current crop of kind of ex-Taliban, people who have been in the Taliban movement and are now out for one reason or another, now living in Kabul. We've had conversation with them. Others have had conversations with them as well, that are less constrained than we are, even, to have frank conversation with people that are still in the movement. And there are changes. There are differences today of what they're willing to agree to, what the Taliban are willing to agree to. For example, it's not total, but there's some significant changes. One example is girls' education. They now agree, which they didn't at all before, that young women, young girls, should go to school. There's some debate within the Taliban as to how old they can go. That is, whether they should stop at 16 or go to college or not. But that is a major change, as you will attest, from what they were before, what they allowed before. Similarly, they used to say this constitution that was put together at Bonn and approved by the puppet government in Kabul, totally rejected. Well, that's not the case anymore. They now are willing to accept the Constitution with a couple of amendments, probably to make clear that it is an Islamic republic. It's already an Islamic republic. That's in the Constitution. What I'm saying is that in conversations that we've had with the Taliban, many of the senior Taliban, as we know, have been killed, are no longer there. It's a new group of people, and they are indicating to us, you're right to be skeptical, that they could negotiate an end to this war. Now, the other thing that is pretty clear is they're not going to, and they recognize, the ones we're talking to, recognize they're not going to run the country. It's not going to be, they ran the country 18 years ago. They recognize they can't do that. They hope that they will have maybe a minister or two. They'd like to, they know something they say about justice. Now it's Sharia, but they know something about justice, they say. They say know something about borders. So there are some parts of the government they say they could, you know, contribute to, and some parts of the country and others not. All to say that it's worth a conversation, which is what we're starting. What do you think?
I think this is just what Henry Kissinger heard from the North Vietnamese. And
you're right to be skeptical, and the proof will be in...
I mean, I haven't talked to the Taliban, so obviously I have no clue. But if I were them, and I were pretty committed to ending up running the country a few years from now, and continuing to do what they had done, which is, in my view, inflicted incredible misery, this is just what I would say to the Americans.
It's a fair question. It's a perfectly fair question. One other bit of information that we get from them when they're open with us, and that is, even though they can't say so publicly at this point, they're willing to accept a continuing U.S. presence or foreign presence, which is, of course, is an anathema to their public position. They've said, no, the one thing they want is all the foreign troops out. Well, first of all, they said, we're going to start conversations with you even while your forces are there. And all we want to do is we want to see a reduction. We want to see that there's a plan for a reduction. That's a big change. All to say that we've been fighting this for 17 years. They've concluded they can't win. We've concluded we can't win militarily. And this is an opportunity to see if we can solve this through negotiations. We will see.
Thank you. I hope you're right.
I do too. Thank you.
Thank you for both perspectives.
Sir.
Next question.
Ambassador, my question was very similar, almost a carbon copy of my associate over there.
And you're convinced now, right?
Well, I found it interesting that in your prepared remarks, you talked...
Barely prepared.
you talked about a 17-year history.
Yep.
To me, that shows the hubris of our universe of statesmen. Call it an 8,000-person population. It is, you know, it isn't huge. It isn't 50,000 people. Between all the people who we've educated at the Harvards of the world, who've done diplomacy, it's really only about 8,000 people.
Okay.
And I think your comment that it's 17 years shows the hubris of us being a relatively young country, when in fact we know this conflict has gone on for decades.
True.
And yet we almost don't acknowledge it. So I'm here to, had you asked me that, I'd say the same thing. I think we're being naive.
What's the alternative, is the question.
Well, that's a very good question. And my answer there is, I love the alternative of diplomacy. I despise the alternative of war. And it seems to me any number of times we get to the diplomatic table after we've first used the guns.
You're absolutely right, and that's exactly what I just described, and that's what I think we're moving away from. That's what we've learned. It took us a long time.
I hope so.
It took us a long time. I hope so, too. I hope you, both of you, are right. Thank you for those questions.
Bob, you have the next question.
Sir.
Yeah, I have a question. It doesn't surprise me that Pakistan and Afghanistan, both of them would like to see a cessation of the hostilities, but I never trusted Pakistan. Secondly, Pakistan has other things on its mind. They're paranoia on the east side.
They are.
Against India.
Absolutely right.
And they're not going to stand down in terms of their capabilities. They're nuclear armed, as is India. Shouldn't India be involved in this colloquy, in this dialogue at some point? I mean, you've got over a billion people sitting on the eastern border of Pakistan. They're not going to step down. They're not going to ease off until they can get...
I think you're absolutely right, and two really important points. First of all, the Pakistanis are very clear with us when we're having these conversations that their big concern is not Afghans, not in Afghanistan, it's not the Taliban. It is exactly what you say, it's India. That's their big concern. Afghanistan may be a means to an end, or it may be subsidiary, or it may help them in their concern, in their fight, in their conflict, in their confrontation with the Indians. That is their, you know, paranoid or not, that is what they're most concerned about. And that was behind Prime Minister Khan's comments to us that we need peace in Afghanistan. It's not just because we're spending a lot of our military resources and others on the border, on that border, on the Afghan border. It's also because they have their real concern on India. So that's the first point, I totally agree. And the second point is also right, and that is the Indians have to be a part of the solution. So we've thought about this process, this peace process, in kind of three concentric circles. One, the first is the Taliban and the Americans, because the Taliban want the American troops out or down, and the government of Afghanistan. So that's the first concentric circle. The second concentric circle is the rest of Afghanistan, because as you point out, they've been fighting for 40 years, not just 17 years, you're absolutely right. And they have grievances, the rest of Afghanistan society. But then there's that third circle. The third circle is the Pakistans, the Indias, the Irans. The Irans are going to be difficult for us because we don't have great relationship with the Iranians. The Central Asians, the Russians, the Chinese. That is really an important component of any lasting peace that we're going to have.
Well, let me congratulate you on give peace a chance, and that seems to be the underlying motive.
This is the Institute of Peace, sir.
Amen.
That's exactly, thank you. Sure.
Yes, thanks for your presentation. Quick question. I think you said that there's many candidates running in Afghanistan
yes.
next year. And I'm gathering, it sounds like there's nobody on the right. It sounds like they're all moderates. And
I'm not sure.
The left?
Moderate may not be the right word.
Okay,
but
that may not
I know
be
what
the right
you mean.
Word.
They're more for peace.
But I'm just curious, since I don't know anything about the Afghanistan election system, we have trouble counting the votes in Florida.
I've heard that. I've heard that.
And that's been for the last 12 years now. I'm wondering who oversees these elections in Afghanistan, and also, do women have the right to vote?
The answer to the last question is yes. It's difficult. There have been attempts made to issue identity cards, and many women are not eager to be photographed. Many women still wear the burqa. And so it's difficult, but yes, they have the right to vote and do. Fact is, again, when I was there a month ago, it's a vibrant democracy. It's messy, but and plastered on every vertical wall are pictures of people who are running, and there are a lot of women running. It was pretty amazing. Some are covered, some are not. So that part. Answer to your first part of the question: who oversees these elections? It's hard, and in some places in Afghanistan, the security is not good enough for an election. You don't have that problem in Florida, you got other problems in Florida, but in Afghanistan, there are whole provinces where they just didn't have election. They didn't run the election because the security was so bad. However, that is overseen. There's an election commission, and the UN is part of the oversight. The international community has helped in every previous election, and the Afghans are figuring, they know how to run elections now, after having done years and years for the last 17 years, 18 years. There is oversight, but they've got a pretty professional election commission to do that, full of challenges, and we'll see again. By the way, in Afghanistan, unlike in Ukraine, there are probably 30 serious candidates. There are probably many more than that. But in Afghanistan, there are probably three collectives, groups that are going to be vying to build their support. Ashraf Ghani, President Ghani is one, Hanif Atmar is another, and then there's a third, maybe Daoudzai. But they're all three, I wouldn't say moderate, but they're all three going to appeal to the people of Afghanistan, saying, I can bring peace better than the others. So thank you for your questions. Sir.
Thanks very much. I'm a retired Foreign Service officer. I worked with Zell in New York and completely agree with your assessment of his abilities and also his particular past that makes him the right person. I hope that you're right and I'm wrong, because I'm very pessimistic. I do think there's going to be a military solution, and I think it will involve Taliban coming back and being in charge. But I hope you're right. I want you to be right.
I do too.
I also speak down here on Russia and Ukraine, not nearly as well as you do, but I speak on it, and I'm pretty pessimistic about that as well, and particularly concerned about this latest episode with the Azov Sea, because beyond just breaking all international laws as they did with Crimea, it touches on freedom of the seas.
Absolutely.
And we've already have a big problem out in the South China Sea with these artificial islands. And it seems to me that the more, not just Russia, but anyone can get away with this, the more we're constricted. Are you as concerned about this? It's gotten some press, but not so much. Are you as concerned about this particular episode as I am?
I am. Bill and I were talking last night about a book we are reading, and many of you have probably read this too. Robert Kaplan has written this book. It's called The Jungle Grows Back. And the metaphor, I think, is apt. The jungle is the natural state. And the natural state in international relations is not peace. The natural state in international relations is war and famine and conflict and rules violation or lack of rules. And that natural state persisted for a long time until World War II. Fact is, The Economist had a great graphic about 2 weeks ago, and it graphed over time the war deaths per 100,000 in the world across the 20th century. And the amazing thing, you can imagine, so the war deaths in the first half of the 20th century, World War I and World War II, off the chart, almost literally off the page of The Economist magazine. When you come, since 1945 till now, it barely registers the number of war deaths. This is not to say famine or genocide or any of those kind of things, but we're talking about war deaths. And the reason that Robert Kagan posits that that is true is that during that 70-year period, from the end of World War II until basically now, great powers and most other powers have lived by some rules. They've respected the sovereignty of other countries. They have not violated borders of other countries. When there's been a dispute, they've taken it to the WTO, or they've taken it to the UN Security Council. There have been institutions and procedures, processes, alliances that have made wars between great powers and thus reducing the number of war deaths dramatically in the second half of the century, the last 70 years. And that's not the natural state. The natural state is the first half with all these fighting and wars. The unnatural state is this last 70 years. And Robert Kagan posits that this is like a garden in the middle of the jungle. And the garden takes tending. The garden takes work. You gotta weed. You gotta cut back the vines. Because if you don't do the work, the name of his book is The Jungle Grows Back. And that's exactly the concern that I have. I share your concern that the Russians are not abiding by these rules. The Russians have decided that the law of the jungle, that the norms since World War II don't apply, and that they would like to have a sphere of influence, which is like previous times. That's the natural state, spheres of influence. Big countries get to dominate little countries. And we haven't had that since World War II. And that little garden has kept the peace in some real sense. There have been some problems, we know, the Korean War and Vietnam War and those kind of things, but they haven't been the same kind of catastrophes as in the first half. So it takes work. It takes work to tend that garden, and the Russians are weeds. So the Kerch Strait and Donbass, those are weeds and vines coming in, and so we need to push back, and it's hard. Bill thinks it may be too late. I'm hoping it's not. I'm hoping it's not too late. I understand your pessimism about this, but I think it's not. We do have to push back on the Russians in this case, and starting in Ukraine,
Yes, next ma'am. And possibly the last question.
In respect to Crimea, you mentioned that you would put together some proposals to help with the problem there. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Be glad.
Can you also talk about how the current administration is accepting of those proposals?
A great question. I'd be glad to. I appreciate the opportunity to do this. So what we've worked out with senior Russians, senior Ukrainians, and Americans is a peace agreement that would involve a UN peacekeeping force. So the United Nations in the Security Council, where the Russians have a veto, so the Russians would have to at least abstain. They can't oppose this. But there are reasons to think that the Russians would like to get out of Donbass. This is not universally accepted, but I believe, and others that I've talked to believe, that they would like to get out of Donbass with some kind of face-saving way. One way that they could do that would be to agree to a peacekeeping force that would come in to Donbass and to the southeastern part of Ukraine, move the illegal militias out. The Russians would remove their troops. An international administration would run the police and the courts and prepare for elections, do the utilities, do the governance, and stage by stage, this would return Donbass to Ukrainian sovereignty. It does require the Russians to at least not oppose it. But your second question is a good one too. What does this administration think of that? We've come back from these conversations, and we've gone to brief Secretary Pompeo, Secretary Mattis, John Bolton, others in the administration who are very interested in this idea, number one. Number two, this administration, President Trump, didn't meet with President Putin in Buenos Aires, which I think is a good thing. There's no reason I can see for our president to meet the President Putin, who was clearly implicated in this attack, this overt attack, the unabashed attack on their neighbor. And so President Trump didn't meet with him. And I think that was a good thing. And so I think that there is an indication that this administration is looking for solutions. We've got a couple of ideas. They're interested in them. So I'm not as hopeful on Russia, Ukraine as I am on Afghanistan, but there's a chance there.
We do have one more question. Rob?
I'll take one more. I'm going to take a different track a little bit. I like your story about 300,000 people returning.
Yes.
It seems to me that the Institute of Peace should be doing a lot more. I wonder, I've spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East myself, I wonder, for one thing, if the people really want to go back that are leaving, and number two, what it takes to motivate them to go back, and what are you doing at Institute Peace to help make that happen?
So on the first parts of your question, these Iraqis, Sunni communities around Tikrit, fled out of fear, mainly stayed within Iraq, maybe stayed in Anbar. So they didn't go abroad, by and large. And when they felt secure enough, when they had confidence that this agreement that their tribal elders had come to with our help, our facilitated help, when they felt secure enough, they have come back voluntarily. It didn't take any pressure for them to come. They wanted to come back to their homes. And this was an indication, a demonstration, evidence that this is a lasting agreement on this thing.
So then part two is these people that are trying to get into Germany and UK, are they really wanting to go back?
I think it's a different set. I think the majority, you will know perhaps better than I, but most of the people in the Middle East going to Europe are coming from Syria, by and large. That is a different, and they still fear for their lives back in Syria. So they're not eager to go back, unlike the Sunni communities around Tikrit. So when I guess the message is when there's confidence that there's some security, when there's confidence that there's some governance in that part of where they want to live, they'll come back voluntarily. When, like the Syrians, they don't have confidence that Bashar al-Assad will protect them, they won't come back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.